Welcome to the Music, Money, and Life podcast. Music, Money, and Life is brought to you by howtolicenseyourmusic.com. For a free 4-hour audio video course all about how to make money licensing your music in TV, films, ads, and more, visit howtolicenseyourmusic.com today. Now let's get to today's podcast.
Welcome back to another episode of Music, Money, and Life. I'm really excited today. I'm speaking with a New York City area-based musician. I'm speaking with Pete Calandra today. Pete, how are you?
I'm good, Aaron. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks so much for doing this. I have quite a few questions for you. Let's start with your background, though, because it looks like you've had a really illustrious career in the music business, both as a performer and as a composer, and you're involved in music licensing as well, but you also, it looks like, have a background in Broadway and doing musical theater. Can you tell us a little bit in your own words about your background and how you got involved in the music business?
Yes. So I started out very young playing the piano, picking things out by ear when I was 5 or 6 years old. And by the time I was 15, I was starting to play, just before my 16th birthday, I started to play in bars on Long Island with different kinds of bands. And I did that all through undergraduate school. Back then, in the late 70s into the early 80s, you could actually play in bar bands and make a living because living was cheaper back then. Yeah. And I worked 4 or 5 nights a week, and my rent was like $160 or $200 a month, and I could make $30, $40, sometimes $50 a night, and all cash, and I could get away with, you know, living. And it wasn't a ton of money, but at least I was working and playing music, and that was sort of like a parallel college to my formal music training at the Copeland School of Music, Queens College, City University of New York. And after school ended, I started, I'm almost immediately, within a few months, I started working off Broadway on this show called Little Shop of Horrors at the Orpheum Theater in the East Village. I started out subbing on the synthesizer and electric keyboard chair. And within 6 or 7 months, Robbie Merkin, who was the full-time keyboard player and the orchestrator of the show, left, and I got hired full-time to play the keyboard chair there. And I stayed with the show for 5 years. I eventually moved over and played the piano book and conducted the show. And then also during that time, I got to be in the Radio City Music Hall Orchestra for the last summer show in the summer of 1984 called Gotta Getaway. And then once Little Shop closed, I started working on Broadway. I started subbing at Phantom of the Opera. And for like a year and a half, I was very busy working there. And then I started doing some theatrical tours, meeting contractors and music supervisors. And I did the Les Miserables national tour for 6 months. And eventually I got hired for the Broadway show Miss Saigon as the principal keyboard player in the fall of 1990. And I did the 6-week rehearsals at 890 Studios at 890 Broadway. And then the show ran for 10 years. I was in the show for 10 years.
Wow.
And then once that closed, I started subbing at the Lion King, and I worked there about 2002 until 2016 when I stopped playing on Broadway. Now, while I was playing on Broadway, I also had other playing gigs. I worked with a man named Larry Rivers, who is a very famous abstract expressionist painter who also started his adult life out as a saxophone player. He went to Juilliard, and he and Miles Davis in the 1940s used to practice in the practice rooms of Juilliard. And even though he became a very famous, world famous painter, he never stopped playing his saxophone and writing music. And I met him in, I think, in the winter of 1986. And we had a band called the Climax Band, which was a jazz ensemble. And so we would do, I stayed with him until he passed away in 2002, I think.
Okay.
He passed. Oh no, maybe it was it 2001 or 2000? I can't remember exactly. I think it was 2001. Actually, he passed away, and yeah. And so we would do all sorts of really interesting gigs. For example, we would. He knew everybody in the Beat Generation. He knew all sorts of poets. He knew authors. We would go to do gigs, and Kurt Vonnegut would be in the audience. David Hockney would be in the audience. Jasper Johns would be in the audience. We would play gigs with Allen Ginsberg, reciting poetry and singing.
Wow.
We did gigs with Don Cherry, the great jazz trumpet player. And that was really, you know, that was an amazing experience being knowing him and for so long. And I learned so much about the business of merging art and commerce and how he approached that, which we can talk about a little later, because I did learn a lot from him about earning a living as an artist. And then also I played gigs with Aretha Franklin, a handful of gigs at a place called the John Harm Center in Englewood, New Jersey. And I played with, I played at Carnegie Hall with the New York Pops a bunch of times. I played with Dee Dee Bridgewater there and Wayne Brady. And, you know, I just did a lot of other gigs. I worked with this woman named Annie Golden, who is a pretty well-known Broadway and TV actress and Broadway singer and actress. Mm-hmm. And she was in the original, she was in the movie Hair. She played the pregnant girl. And she was also in a punk band called The Shirts at CBGB's. That's where Milos Forman discovered her and put her in that. And we played gigs at Joe's Pub for several years. Just piano and voice. So I had like a really, and I do recording sessions in the city, a few a month, all sorts of stuff. So I had a really great career as a pianist, and all the time that I was playing the piano, I was very interested in recording and technology, and I bought into the home recording thing very early. I got a TIAC Porta Studio 4-track cassette deck. And I purchased a drum machine by Yamaha and a little hardware sequencer by Yamaha and a DX7 and a Juno 106 and a little, you know, and I used the Porta Studio as my mixer. I'd have, you know, four inputs plugged into it so I could hear everything that I was sequencing. And I learned the basics through trial and error of recording and sequencing, and I stayed with it. And then in the early 90s, I bought my first computer, and all of the techniques that I had learned from sequencing for 8 years with little hardware sequencers, because I got a more advanced Yamaha sequencer, and then I got a Roland MC50 with a floppy disk. All the techniques I learned, I was able to port that all over into computer using a software called Vision, and then it became Studio Vision. And then, so I was very interested in recording and technology and music production. I did a lot of producing for various artists, like Annie Golden. I produced a bunch of music for her, and another woman named Jennifer Lee Warren. We wrote some songs and recorded a bunch of them. And so I had really done a lot of that work. And then once I got involved with Miss Saigon, I started getting, you know, when I was playing in bar bands, I was oftentimes the youngest person in the band, and I was playing with people 10 or 15 years older than me doing the same gigs. And then by the time I started playing Miss Saigon, I started seeing that I was really kind of boxed into a career where I was always going to be playing a show, and maybe I didn't like the music so much, but I had to do the gig because they are great gigs, and they pay a decent, like, you know, middle-class living with health insurance and pension benefits and job security if you're in a hit show. And you don't have to lug equipment around. So it's really great in a lot of ways. But
yeah,
as somebody who's always been incredibly creative, so many years of playing like a show like Miss Saigon with the piano book was incredibly intricate and central to the show. The whole orchestration was written around the piano book. And it was like playing a mini concerto every night that I worked there. And it's the same thing over and over again, the same notes. You know, shows are a little bit different because the pacing's a little bit different. People have different energy. Different people are on the stage. They might have different pacing when they're singing songs. There are different musicians in the band when they get subs coming in. So things are a little bit different. But basically, you're playing like 90% the same thing every night. And, you know, there are some people that's their thing. You know, they're recreative musicians where they recreate music that's been written by somebody else, and they put their personal stamp on it, and that's great. But for someone like myself, who I've always been a creative musician, I've found that while I was incredibly privileged and honored and thankful to have all of these playing gigs, right, I wasn't really enjoying them by like around 93 or so. And I went back to college and I got my master's degree in composition, and I studied with a woman named Thea Musgrave, who's a very well-known Scottish opera composer. And so I really worked on my compositional skills. And then I started getting work towards the late 90s, writing production music. And I spent a few years doing that. I did stuff for Fox Sports, for NBC Sports, for Killer Tracks. And then as I'm doing this work, I'm getting my production skills better. My composition skills are getting better. I'm learning how to work on a deadline. I'm just getting paid, basically, to get better at what I'm doing.
Right.
And the other flip side of that was that I put together a portfolio of music that I could submit to people to hear what I was doing as a composer. And then I started getting some independent films, a few short films. And then I got a feature film called 13th Child, Legend of the Jersey Devil, which had it was an interesting project because the film ended up not being really great, to be honest with you. And but it was a great project to work on it. And there was like Cliff Robertson. Was it like there were people in it that had done things in the acting industry, you know, 10 years before. And it did, like Robert Guillaume, a very famous TV actor, was in it. And there are a few other people whose names escape me right now that you would recognize if you're my age that were in it. And but it got shown in the theater, and I got experience doing a feature film. And then I got a few other independent feature films that did, one called Unknown Soldier, and then the next year one called Jelly Smoke, and they did really, really well on the independent film scene. They both won the Los Angeles Film Festival. Unknown Soldier won the Philadelphia Film Festival, and it played in festivals all over the world. And then it eventually got stalled to Stars and BET. And again, I'm, you know, working on my craft. I'm getting better. I'm leading sessions to record the music for this stuff. So this is going on while I'm doing production music. And then I start getting some opportunities to pitch for theme songs for sports programming.
Okay.
And yeah, and so the very first one that I pitched and won was a very well-known sports commentator named Max Kellerman, who was on ESPN for a long time, and he's an expert on boxing, and he's also very intelligent. He went to Columbia, very smart man. He had he got signed away from ESPN onto Fox Sports Net, which was just starting up at this time. This is like 2004, I think. Mm-hmm. And I won the theme song for his show, and then there were more that came up. So that over the course of like the next 12 years or so, I did somewhere between 40 and 50 theme packages for Fox Sports, for the Big Ten Network, for SNY here in New York, for ESPN, for Comcast Sportsnet, which eventually became the NBC Sportsnet. And it was really incredible because it was something that I sort of had a knack for, you know, writing sports themes and branding a television show with a memorable mnemonic that when people would hear it, they would know that this show was on. And that sort of led to like my biggest get, which was I won the Fox Sports FIFA World Cup theme. And I was working with a producer in New York named Scott Schreer, who was working directly with this guy named George Greenberg, who is the vice president of Fox Sports. And I work with them, and we pitched, and I, you know, it won, and it's been on the air since 2015. And then I also did stuff for ESPN, their Special Olympics theme, their Invictus Games theme. Still writing production music, and then this sort of production music for me sort of stopped in 2008. And I started working, getting a lot of documentary films, and I've done a lot of documentary films for ESPN, for PBS, for Sesame Street, for Oprah, for CNN, probably scored close to 100 films right now. Now, you know, they're not all 90-minute films. You know, there's a bunch of short films, 10 minutes long. There's 30-minute TV films. There's 60-minute TV films. And then there are a bunch of feature-length films, you know, and so I did that for a long time. And then I think in about 2012, I started teaching at my alma mater, the Copeland School of Music, and I've been teaching there for 12 years. I teach music production, film scoring, composition, and I am the area coordinator for the music and production program that I helped to found there. So that's been very rewarding, and I'm an adjunct, so I teach two classes a semester, and I still pursue all this other stuff. And then at some point in the early 2010s, I decided to start releasing my own albums independently, taking all the skills I had learned, because I could engineer, record, mix, and master, and do all that stuff. And I do get help with mixing and mastering for some stuff with my friend Ken Freeman, who does the front of house mixing for Toto. He mixes a lot of my stuff with me, but I do a lot of the mixing as well with him. And then I give it to him, and he does the final polishing, which makes it sound twice, three times better. But, you know, and so at this point, I think I've put out about 15 albums, something like that. And so, you know, I work, and I get up every day and I work, and I love doing it. And I have a nice project studio in my house. And that's one of the reasons why we moved out, because it was getting really difficult to do this work in an apartment in Manhattan. And I had rented spaces in Manhattan, like in larger studios, but that started getting insanely expensive and also difficult to come by, because a lot of people were moving their productions out of large spaces into their home. You know, that's
right.
The technology revolution really changed the way that the music industry has functioned. Anyway, so that's, you know, that's not short, but there's a lot to get through. And I think that's pretty much going through everything.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. You've done so much. You actually answered several of the questions I had for you. I want to circle back to what you've done in the licensing space, because that's really the focus of this podcast. And I think most of my listeners would be interested in knowing how you broke into licensing, and you know, if you have any advice in terms of how other composers can break into licensing as well. But let's do that in a moment. I don't think I've ever interviewed anybody who has worked on Broadway. So I know it sounds like you found the work somewhat confining creatively, but can you talk about aspects of working on Broadway that you liked, and maybe just describe what your day-to-day life was like when you worked on Broadway?
Yes. So every day that you're working on Broadway, you're playing with some of the best musicians, certainly in New York, but in the world, right? They are the best at what they do. There are people that play regularly on Broadway that are extras at the New York Philharmonic, extras at the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra, the City Ballet. You have people that do studio work, what studio work there is there. You have people who had very intense jazz gigs when they were younger, say playing lead trumpet with the Maynard Ferguson Big Band or Woody Herman and the Thundering Herd, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s and through that time period. And you every day you're playing with these unbelievably great musicians, and it really makes you a better musician, because you need to aspire to fit in with these people. And then there's the people on stage that you're accompanying every night as a pianist, playing for Tony Award winners, right? Playing for with Leah Salonga, the great singer, you know, actress, singer. She was in Miss Saigon, you know, playing with amazing singers. And then there's the friendships that you make with these people. I'm still incredibly close with the musicians that were in the Little Shop of Horrors band. That I started working there in 1982. That's like 42 years ago. And I just was talking to the bass player last week. I texted with the drummer the other day. You know, it's just the original music director, I had a couple texts with him last week. So it's like you create these really meaningful friendships, because you're working so intimately with people basically on a daily basis. And so you meet these, you make great friends. Like this summer, I'm going to take a trip to California, and I'm going to meet up with some of the Little Shop cast members that I'm still friends with, you know, and we have Facebook groups for all of the shows that I've been in, and we stay in touch with the actors and actresses and the musicians through that. You just see the kinds of lives that some of these people that you met when I was 30 at Miss Saigon, and they were teenagers still, 19 years old, some of the cast members. Mm-hmm. And you see now that they're, you know, they're sending their kids to college and they're grown adults and they've lived their lives, and you just make these incredible connections. On another musical positive, which I think that some of your listeners might find interesting, is that I got to listen to and play incredible orchestrations by incredible orchestrators. So playing in the Phantom of the Opera Orchestra, which was like almost like a small chamber orchestra, sort of like a classical music, you know, very romantic, rich, lush, listening to how the strings were orchestrated, listening how a great orchestrator would use the woodwinds and how he would have people doubling, like playing bass clarinet for the first 16 bars, then moving over to regular clarinet, then back to bass clarinet, and then maybe at the very end playing that hideous E-flat clarinet, you know, and seeing all the different, taking four wind players, you know, a bassoonist, a clarinetist, and somebody who played clarinet and flute, and then a flutist, and seeing how all the different colors that you can get by people doubling, and learning how they create these beautiful background melodies in the background of the songs that bring life to some of this music, and how it brings color and emotion to it. And then the other benefit too is sitting in a pit, and somebody like myself who has written a lot of orchestral music, listening to how French horn players play, how they phrase things, how trumpet players phrase things, how wind players, how having to double and play with the concert master or the concert mistress of a string section, and that when you're playing a keyboard, sometimes you're doubling them and you need to fit in with them and sound like you're part of the section. And you learn through all this articulations, you learn different colors, like if something is concertino with mutes, if something is, you know, being played over the fingerboard but with no mutes, or playing close to the bridge, and how all these different sounds and articulations are used as part of the orchestration to bring these beautifully rich and detailed colors to an arrangement. And this is something that I try to impart upon my students that are taking film scoring classes with me, about how your orchestration can really sell your music, and how it brings a lot of interest by not just having one person play a line for 20 minutes, you know, by changing things around, changing registers, changing colors, doubling in octaves, doing all sorts of things, changing the articulations and the playing techniques. So these are some of the educational aspects of playing in large orchestras like that. You know, I mean, when I was the one playing in the Radio City Orchestra, you know, there are 45 musicians in that orchestra, right? It's an interesting experience for someone who played rhythm section music his entire growing up period.
No, I can imagine that sounds really exciting. What was what is sort of the day-to-day life of a musician working on Broadway like? Are you rehearsing on an ongoing basis, or once you have the show kind of locked in, like how does that work?
Okay, so there's three types of musicians, I think. Would it be three? Oh, let's see. Let's go with three, and if I need to adjust it, I will. You have the people that are in the orchestra that are full-time employees. You have substitute musicians who maybe who have a show, and then the show closes, and then they learn the books to like three or four different shows. And, you know, over the course of the week, they could be playing, you know, four or five times in a different show every night. And then you have people who are part of the management team in the orchestra, and that would be the conductor and usually the keyboard players. And so keyboard players in Broadway shows typically have to play rehearsals, cast rehearsals during the week.
Okay.
And that can range from not at all to like 20 to 30 hours if there's a lot of replacement people coming in or people taking vacations and stuff. So that's a lot of work. I tended to not do that, be fortunate to not have to do that.
Okay.
Because I didn't like it. And it was also a good way to get your subs or other people some employment, right? Because that all gets paid hourly by union rates. So it's not a bad way for somebody to supplement, a freelancer to supplement their income. So basically for me, what I would do, since I wasn't doing a lot of rehearsals, and you do have band rehearsals occasionally, like if a new principal cast member comes in, you know, if there's like four people who are the lead people in a musical and they've got like big numbers, you will have some rehearsals, you know, the few days before they go in, just to make sure that they're comfortable when they're being, you know, they're doing their dry run through. You'll have a run through with them and go over any, you know, the different ways that they might be doing the interpretation of the songs, and you lock that in. So yes, there are some orchestra rehearsals. And then there are orchestra rehearsals during the course of a run when a show's been running for a long time to clean stuff up.
Right.
You know, things get sloppy. People start playing things a different way. Maybe some people have left and some new people came in and they play the show differently than the original person did. So you do have these occasional times where there are orchestra rehearsals to clean things up. But
gotcha.
For the most part, for me, you know, I would get up in the morning. I like to do my exercise in the morning, go out for a run, ride my bike in the city in Central Park or, you know, or wherever. And then I'd come back home and I'd spend a few hours practicing the piano, take a break, maybe go for a little walk. If I have any errands to run, I take care of that. And let's say I get back into my apartment around, 2 o'clock, I might spend a couple of hours working on, this is before I started getting projects. I work on my writing and my technology stuff. And then, you know, I'd shut all that down around 4:30 or so. I'd take a good hour nap, get up, take a shower, eat something, and get on the subway. And since I was living on the Upper West Side, it was basically 2 stops on the 2 train or the 3 train to get to the Times Square area. So, and try to get into the theater by 7:15 and, you know, clean off my keyboards, make sure everything works, make sure all my sounds are coming up and warm up. And then, you know, have a cup of coffee, and then the show starts at the 8 o'clock show. The downbeat is somewhere between 8:05 and 8:10, and then the show ends. Some people go out after the show. Some people are night birds and they stay up late. I'm not a night bird. So I would typically get home after the show, and you know, be asleep like within 40 minutes of getting home.
Well, it sounds like a cool gig, but like you said, I can imagine that it would also be confining in terms of creativity. Let's talk about when you pivoted into music licensing and doing production music. I know you said you did a number of theme songs initially. How did you break into the business? How did you get started? Was it through a music library or through someone you knew or connections you had? Can you talk a little bit about that, and also any advice you have for aspiring composers trying to break into production music in 2024?
Sure. So one of the benefits of another benefit of playing shows is that you meet people, right? So when I was playing Little Shop of Horrors, a guy named John Siegler came in and subbed on the bass guitar. And John was a very successful musician. He was in Todd Rundgren's original Utopia. He was in Hall & Oates. He was a session musician. He'd recorded with Meatloaf, with Roger Daltrey, with Mick Jagger, with Jeff Beck. And he was doing a lot of work. And then he was also playing bass on jingles, a lot of jingles, right? TV commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was out of touch with him for a long time. And then around 1998, I was between shows on a Wednesday at Miss Saigon, and I was walking down 9th Avenue. I had just eaten something. I needed to go to a store for a second, and I ran into him, and we had a conversation. I hadn't seen him in I hadn't seen him in maybe 10 years. And so we had a long conversation, and he told me that he had been writing music for this company called Paradise, which was a big jingle house, and they had a studio in Hell's Kitchen, and they shared a live space with another company called Not Just Jingles, and the owner of Not Just Jingles had just signed this huge contract with Fox to write promo music and sports highlight music, and so I was going to be working for John's company, Paradise, but they were subcontracting out the work from this NJJ company with this Scott Schrier fellow. And so I started working on promo music for Fox Television Network. And I wrote a bunch of 2-minute promo tracks for that. And they needed to write, I think it was 250 tracks for this library. So I did probably over the course of like 8 months or 9 months, I did about 30 or 40 of them. And I didn't quite at that point have my home recording thing down really well. So I used to have to rely on other people to help me with some of the stuff. So in other words, if I needed a guitar player, I used to have to wait for a guitar player to come through. And, my mixing wasn't really as good as it should have been at that point, so I'd have to get somebody to help me mix this stuff. And basically the way it worked was that we got a $500 or $700 stipend to write this stuff, and then you kept the back end money as a writer on BMI Writer. So then that flipped into doing promos for Fox Sports. And at this point, I sort of stopped being subcontracted out, and I worked directly for this NJJ company. And I wrote, I think, about 50 of these promo of these sports highlight music, which is basically the music you hear when they're doing recaps of the day's action. So let's say you're watching the NFL on Fox, and at halftime they're showing highlights from the other game, right? Or they might have a recap show at the end of the night where they're showing the day's action and it's the music underneath. Or if they do a little video, they'd have their own library, so they wouldn't have to go and use another production music library. So I did a bunch of those. And then that led into Scott getting a job for NBC Sports to work on the 2000 Olympics in Sydney. And I wrote over at this point, I had gotten much better with my production skills, and so I was still playing the piano at night at Miss Saigon. So I was making my rent through that. And the money that I was getting from writing the production music, I was investing back in technology for my studio. So I used some of that money and I purchased 3 Kurzweil K2500 samplers. I purchased a couple of Roland S760 samplers. I bought sample libraries. And I purchased a Yamaha O2R mixing console and, an DAT machine. So I was getting better at mixing and I had better sounds for the time. And so when this job came up for NBC, I wrote 125 tracks over the course of like 8 months. I was just churning it out. So basically at that point, this was 1999, I stopped playing all matinees at the show, and I stopped playing matinees at the show, and I started just working at Miss Saigon. I'm just trying to think what my exact schedule is. So instead of playing Monday through Saturday, I would take off. I would work Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. I'd take off Thursday, and I'd play Friday and Saturday night, and I wouldn't do any of the matinees. So basically, I was writing. And I wasn't practicing the piano as much at this point. Maybe I'd do like a half an hour of warm up in the morning. Right. And I was basically spending 6 or 8 hours a day writing and recording and then taking a break and going and playing the show at night. So I did that for like almost a year. And again, all this skill learning on the job got my chops and my technique and my writing and technology technique much, much better.
Yeah.
And so then this led to work for Killer Tracks.
They're a music library, right?
Yes. And at that time, and this is how the business has changed. At that time, there were a bunch of independent production music libraries. There was Killer Tracks based in Los Angeles. There was Network Music based in San Diego. There was a place, something called Omni Music based in Port Washington out on Long Island. And there was like DeWolf, which I think was a European library, but they were all independent and they paid you money up front to write that you got to keep.
Right.
And you kept all the back end money, all the writer's share of your performance royalties, and then you'd get like every year or so, you'd get a couple times a year, you'd get some needle drop money up front. And so, you know, it was, again, I did like 150 tracks for Killer Tracks over like 5 or 6 years. So I did a lot of that work with them. And towards the end of that run, the business started changing. So the original family that started Killer Tracks sold it to another company, and the direction of the company changed, and the producers there wanted to bring in their own writers, so I stopped getting called to do those. And then large entities like BMG, Sony, Universal started buying up all of these independent library companies. And it got, and then so that happened, and that had an effect on getting involved with writing production music. And then the next thing that happened, which is where we are today, is that there started sprouting up a lot of smaller library companies that didn't want to pay any money up front, that wanted you to write music and license it to them, and then you would just keep the back end.
Right, which is super common now.
Well, that's the business model now. And, you know, the one thing I found that was really interesting and was really a negative for me and sort of pushed me away from doing production music is by 2006 or so, I was getting a nice stipend every year from BMI. You know, it was a nice supplement because I was still working at night, and I was getting paid up front, and I was doing some of these other projects that I was talking about. And then Killer Tracks started doing direct licensing deals with the broadcasters, and that sort of killed what we were getting in BMI. So that, let's say I was making from my Killer Tracks stuff, you know, $30,000 or $40,000 a year in BMI money, that got brought down to like $8,000 or $10,000 a year over the course of like a year or so.
Yeah, big difference.
Yeah, you know, you go from being comfortable with all your other revenue streams, because the way you have to work in this industry is you have to have multiple ways that you're making a living.
Right.
And then they all add up to a nice, if you're successful, they all add up to a nice taste at the end of the year, right?
Right.
Comfortable, as long as you don't try to live extravagantly, you live within your means. And so that sort of left a bad taste in my mouth. And to be honest with you, if I was, you know, in my 20s and 30s of starting out right now, it's very difficult, you know, to be successful in this endeavor.
Yeah.
And
I feel like just the music business in general, sort of across the board. I mean, at the beginning of this podcast, you talked about how you used to be able to make a living playing in a bar band, and how that is obviously, it's a lot harder now.
Well, let's put it this way, right? So in 1978 to 1982, when I was, you know, playing and going to college,
mm-hmm.
I was making, you know, $8,000 or $9,000 a year playing piano in bar bands, wedding bands, function gigs. My rent was $175 a month. Gas was 65 cents a gallon. My car insurance was $200 a year. My college tuition was $385 a semester.
Right.
Okay, yeah, so sure. my students now pay like $1,200 a month to share an apartment in Bushwick somewhere, like very inconvenient to get anywhere from.
Yeah.
Gas is like $3.50 a gallon. Car insurance is up through the roof. So, you know, and so I do play in a band currently up here in the Hudson Valley, just a fun, it's a cover band, a soul band.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we get like, we do $100 gigs.
Yeah.
So that's like twice what I was making. But the expenses are like, if I needed that to make a living, I do it for fun and for pocket change. But just think about how much more expensive it is to live now and how little the money has gone up.
Yeah. It's really hard. It's challenging. I like to be realistic on this podcast and, you know, with everything I put out, but I also like to be optimistic. So is there a sense of optimism anywhere in this? I mean, I see a lot of bands, there's still great music out there and there's still great live music. So in that sense, I'm optimistic, but what sort of advice do you have? Is there a silver lining somewhere?
Well, yeah. So what I would say is that the first thing that, if I was a younger person, just trying to break into this, you need to have a stable life.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Very
you
important.
You need to do something where you're bringing in money and you have a stable living situation, right? Now you're fortunate that you could have a laptop, a MIDI keyboard, and headphones, and you can create some unbelievable music.
Right.
So you could set that up in a bedroom.
Yeah. So maybe that's the upside, that it's the barrier to entry is a lot lower.
Well, that also produces a lot of bad music because the entry barrier
true.
Is a lot lower, and a lot of people who are who have no talent at all and shouldn't be doing this have access to make music, and there's just so much content being released.
Yeah.
But what I would say is that success is where preparation meets opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? I love that quote.
So I've been preparing since I was a little kid, a child, 5 years old, for that day that I met John Siegler walking down 9th Avenue, for that opportunity. And I wasn't fully developed yet into like what I would consider a final polished product, but I got the opportunity to learn on the job.
Yeah.
But I had so much preparation before that, that when the opportunity came, I was able to be successful at it.
Yeah.
And I find that, you know, if somebody gives you an opportunity and you do a good job, but there's some stuff that needs to be, that's not right, and they give you some feedback on that, as long as you're open and willing to listen to that and to try to effectuate those changes, they'll probably call you again. You know, if you get rejected, but you throw a hissy fit about it, they're not going to call you again. Right. And if you do a good job and they treat you badly, then you don't really want to work for those people anyway. So what I would say is that you, as a younger person, you need to get a stable, secure living situation as best you can. And you need to live within yourself. And you need to learn how to make do with what you can afford.
Yeah. Live within your means.
So in other words, I've got, you know, 15 terabytes of like the top sample libraries in my computer. I can afford that, and I've also been collecting them for 20 years, right? So that's fine. Well, if you're younger and starting out, you have to get what you can. You know, there's a lot of tools out there that, and you have to plan and slowly build up your palette and your arsenal of sounds, but you need to learn, you need to get as much skill as you can, and you need to learn arranging and orchestrational skills, because they are very helpful in terms of presenting your ideas, and you need to learn, you need to be incredibly prolific using a sequencer. And you need to be almost an expert in using a sequencer. Now, you might not know every facet of using a sequencer, but you need to be an expert on the stuff that you do need to know. So, like for myself, for example, I use Pro Tools. I know Pro Tools really well, but I don't know all the things that like somebody who does ADSR does, you know, because I never do that. That's
right.
Not my focus. I don't need to learn that. But doing MIDI and recording and mixing on Pro Tools, I know how to do that really, really well. Can I learn more on the software? Yes, I can, and I do. I work. But, so those are some of the things. And you also need to, you know, there's this double-edged sword, because doing production music, you almost have to be a chameleon where you can sort of fit into any style. And that's sort of how I ran my playing career, where I could play. I was the kind of guy who got hired because I could fit in incredibly comfortably with a rhythm section, and I could play and accompany a vocalist with just piano and voice, or I could play with a conductor and be inside of an orchestra, you know, playing orchestral piano, or I could drive an orchestra from the piano, because I had a lot of experience playing piano and conducting at Little Shop of Horrors. So, and I could play a lot of different styles of music really well. So I sort of had that, that was sort of who I was and why I got hired. I could read music and I could play off the page. I could read chord charts, you know, fully notated scores. I could be given a sketch and then make up my own part that fit in really well. So I got hired for all those different skills. So as far as being a composer goes, you have two ways of playing it. You could be somebody who's very facile with different styles, or you could be somebody who has a unique sound. And you know, and that's and you're being hired for your sound, right? So as far as licensing goes, you know, if you have things that create things that tell a story, that's a big part of licensing music for visual medium, right? You have to understand the basics of telling a story. And to be honest with you, I don't think that's something that AI can quite do right now. And I don't know how long it'll take them to get that going, but you need to be able to tell a story in your music. So one of the other benefits that I didn't mention about Broadway was that I spent 35 years of my life, you know, and part of that overlapped, a big part of that overlapped with my writing career.
Right.
But I spent a huge portion of my life playing music that was in service of telling a story.
Yeah.
And that's what all great art is. And that's, you know, your music that you create has to be storytelling music, no matter what you're doing. And the other thing I would say is when you're writing music, learn how to write music that doesn't get in the way of dialogue, but is still interesting and has beautiful textures and does have melodies, but that those melodies are not like, you know, Donna Lee by Charlie Parker, that's like 5 million notes, right? Where you can say a lot with less amount of melodic content. And just you just have to go out and meet people. You know, if you want to score films, you maybe, you know, you meet other film composers and maybe you can start working as an intern for them. But, you know, go to film festivals and meet filmmakers. They're the ones that are going to hire you, you know. That's what I did. You know, there were film festivals in New York that I used to go to. And I gave out my card and my reel at a lot of these things. And I would get, like, some of these small independent films. And that's another way that I worked.
Well, you've obviously been doing something right all these years. So you've worn so many different hats. I just have a couple more questions for you, then I'll let you go. We're almost at about an hour here.
I'm sorry to keep you so long.
No, this is great. I feel like I could speak with you for hours and hours. I have so many questions, but I don't want to go too long. But so you've played in bar bands, you've played on Broadway, you've scored films, you've done licensing work and production music work. What do you enjoy the most? What is your sort of favorite aspect of being a musician?
It's interesting because at different points in my life, it's something different.
Yeah.
You know, when I first started playing in shows, I loved it. It was great. I was playing Little Shop of Horrors, like the perfect show for me because it was in the East Village of New York. It was like the early mid 80s. It was really incredible area to be in. The show was really funny. Like, you know, the first time I went to see the show to start learning it, Robert Redford and Cher were there. I played Michael Jackson came like multiple times when we did the show, and then not with him, but with a lot of people, you'd get to meet them afterwards.
Right.
You know, like I met Lucille Ball and Jackie Gleason and Carol Channing and just all these people. Like, you know, Eddie Murphy came, Jamie Lee Curtis came. I'm forgetting many, many, many people who came, and you'd have meet and greets after the show. So it was really exciting, you know.
Yeah, I can imagine.
My early and mid 20s. So, and then after a while, I didn't like that so much, you know.
And why is that? What? I'm just curious.
The repetition, and the fact that also that I, for 10 years in Miss Saigon, I played a show that was incredibly physically difficult. The pit was unbelievably loud, so it was uncomfortable for me to be in it many nights.
Yeah.
I used to have to wear earplugs and gun mufflers. That's how loud it was.
Wow.
And the story was really depressing.
So even you know, the short story itself started to weigh on you a little.
Yeah, well, you know, she kills herself every night, right? It's like Madame Butterfly set in Vietnam. So there's that. And then, you know, I enjoyed writing production music because that was exciting too. I'm like getting paid to write music and I can write all these different styles. And I love that. And then I liked writing film music for a while. But then, you know, what happened I didn't really get into like, you know, top shelf films. You know, a lot of documentary work. I worked for networks, and it was great work because all the films, the documentary films I did, told fantastic stories, and I was really proud of them all. And I worked with great filmmakers, and we had great working relationships, and it was really great. But then what started happening over the last few years with films is that the amount of approvals above the filmmakers started exponentially growing. So let's say we'd work on a film, 60-minute film. So I'd work with the filmmakers for, a couple of months on this film, and we have a great working relationship. You know, we'd get the language set up, and then I'd score parts of the film, and then I'd get some feedback, and maybe, I'd have to make some adjustments, or maybe they'd re-edit something and I'd have to do some conforming with the music. Or maybe I'd hand it in and they'd be like, that's great. We love that the way it is. But it was a cordial and really back and forth, respectful relationship. Well, then they have to give it up to ESPN. And they've got like 15, producers at ESPN, and each one has a different opinion. And then the filmmakers would have to go recut the film and have to redo the music. And then another person would have to approve it. And then the same thing would go on. And then if, let's say it was dealing with an athlete who was in the SEC conference, right? Well, then the SEC would have to see it, and they'd have feedback. And then the college that was involved and the person that was the focal point, they'd all have feedback. So at the end of the day, you're like writing the score four times or five times, and you're not making any more money, and it's taking like four or five times longer.
Right.
And it's incredibly frustrating because once you start having to rework things and, try to get things to fit in, the quality of the music just gets worse and worse. And it becomes really frustrating. And and since I'm a one-person operation, everything fell on my shoulders, I couldn't outsource something to an assistant. So I stopped really enjoying that too. And then now I'm enjoying putting out my own music. I love being able to write music and put it out, but the reality is that I'm a little older now, and I write instrumental music, and there's just not a huge market for it. So I'm just thankful for any listens I get. And that's the other thing about my career, is that I've done all this stuff and I've been incredibly successful, not just with the prestige jobs that I've done in terms of Broadway and, the number of films I've scored and the theme songs I've written, but, a lot of this stuff is I'm behind the scenes. I'm not a household name. I'm not Hans Zimmer. I'm not, I'm not Herbie Hancock. I'm not Keith Jarrett. I'm not Bruce Hornsby. I'm not Claude Michel Schoenberg. I'm not Andrew Lloyd Webber. I'm not any of these people. I'm somebody who's just been incredibly fortunate, who's worked really hard, who's earned a really good living, and who's always worked.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot of stuff that I'm really proud of. But again, it's all been sort of as a support act, almost like you're the invisible accompanist. Like, do you know who Frank Sinatra's pianist was, who played on all those recordings with him? No, none of us know the guy's name, right? But he was there, and Frank hired him over and over again because he was so great.
Yeah.
So, it's that kind of a thing. And that's sort of the life of a working musician, or a working artist.
But you've been able to obviously make a living all these years doing something you love.
Yep.
And that's no small accomplishment, I feel like, in the context of the music business. That's
Right. But the thing is that I've been fortunate enough that when I stopped liking something, I've been able to move on to something else. And a lot of people don't have that option.
This is
right.
True.
Now, so I'm very thankful for that. And I'm very thankful for that. I'm thankful also that I'm in a position in life where I don't have to take everything that comes along because I worked so hard as a younger man, as an artist. So, and I can put out my own albums and self-fund it and end up owning all the music that I write, Oh, that's one thing I want to tell you. If you end up doing independent films, right, and they have ugats to pay you, work out a deal with them where you're giving them a non-exclusive license to use your music in their film, but that you end up owning the copyright.
Yeah, and you still retain the copyright.
Right, so let me tell you why this is great, because when I did that film I talked about earlier, Unknown Soldier, which was one of my first successful independent films, that they had $4,000 to pay me for that score, And I sunk everything into, because there was a lot of, there was jazz music in the score. I sunk everything into recording the live musicians, and you know, I upgraded some of my technology. And so I had rent to pay because I was in a small room in a post-production facility in Midtown Manhattan. So I walked away with nothing in my pocket. They sold the film to Stars and BET, and for 6 years, it was on 3 or 4 times a month. So at the end of that time period, because I owned the publishing and the songwriter, I ended up making about $40,000 for like 6 weeks worth of work.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Right.
Yeah, and so see, that, these are the stories I'm interested in hearing because, yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah. Well, the other thing too is theme songs. Theme songs are really beneficial financially because a theme song pays something like 15 times more than underscore.
Right, because it's featured so prominently.
Well, that's just the rules at BMI. So, you know, I could have for one television show that, like say, I wrote the theme song for Sportsnet Central, for Sportsnet on the Comcast Sportsnet. That show was on in the Bay Area, Sacramento, Los Angeles, Chicago, Detroit, I believe in Denver. Up in Boston, in Philadelphia, and in Washington, D.C. So that's like about 10 or 12 different networks. And the show would air at like 10:30, 11 o'clock every night. And then it would repeat 6 or 7 times over the course of the day.
Yeah.
So that my theme song was being, it was like I had a theme song on, I don't know, like 70 television shows every day.
Yeah. And I'm sure
so
that
the royalties from that one show, right? The royalties from that one show every quarter was like 5 times, the 300 or 400 other songs that I had going on as just background music, like on Lifetime and, you know, or anything else. And then the other thing too is that football is the most viewed television show in America.
Right.
So I had a couple of my library pieces picked up by Football Night in America, which is on NBC. And they were on the show for 10 years. So over that 17-week period, it was prime time, the highest rated show every week. So that means it's the highest advertising rates. And it means that it paid the most money into BMI. So I had 2 songs that were used at halftime, pregame show when they were showing highlights, and then at the halftime. So I'd have like 3 So, you know, depending upon the week, 2, 3, 4, sometimes even 5 minutes worth of music on a Sunday night, prime time, the most viewed show over the week. And those would sometimes pay me like, I don't know, $1,300 or $1,400 in a week.
Yeah. No, that's awesome.
And that was background music, right? And so,
right.
But that was on prime time on a big network and on the highest rated program of the week.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, that's super cool. So are you – just 1 or 2 more questions, then I'll let you go. I actually have to run here shortly myself. Are you – so I know that you said you're not as involved with production music now. To what extent are you still involved with licensing? What are you doing licensing-wise currently?
Right now, I've got music in some different companies. I have something called Music Beyond. I've licensed a bunch of some music for them. I have stuff in Audio Sparks, which you know, they're very nice people, but I actually wish that I didn't do that because they have so much music that your music gets lost and then you can't get it off of there.
Right.
I did some work for a company called, I licensed out music to a company called Scorekeepers. Mm-hmm. And so I did that for about 5 years. Then I took that music down because, again, it wasn't really bringing me in any money and they wanted exclusive rights. So right now I'm sort of like, I'm not doing anything right now actively to pursue that. What I am thinking about, though, is I've got all this music that I've written for my albums, and a lot of it is incredibly storytelling music, right? It's you know, and it's all sorts of styles. I need to collate all this stuff and get it in a package. I need to find a place that will represent and try to license my music as opposed to giving it to a large company where it just becomes
right, just hoping
part of part of their numbers.
Yeah, no, I understand.
Oh, yeah, we've got 20,000 tracks, and you've got like, 20 of those 20,000 tracks. You'll never...
Yeah, no, I completely understand. I've had very similar experiences. I don't like to mention companies by name on this podcast, but I know where you're coming from. I'll just put it that way. But Pete, let's do this.
Let me just do one more
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, sure.
I am licensing out 15 tracks right now to Sirius XM on their spa channel. I just thought of it.
Oh, nice. Oh, cool.
And that actually pays out, I can't tell you what the number is, but it pays out a nice stipend every month.
Good. Yeah, that's what I'm looking for, because I know how hard it is out there for composers and musicians, and I want to be real. You know, I want to give people real information, but I also want to give people, encouraging information. So that's good to hear. But let's do this. I know you have new music, your own music that you're releasing. What I like to do at the end of each podcast is, well, first, let's tell people where they can learn more about you and your music. So if someone's listening to this and they want to learn
You'll find me on the Instagram at Pete Calandra Music, and I have a Facebook page, Pete Calandra Music, and my website is www.petecalandramusic.com. So you can find out a lot of information about me in any of those spots. And my current album is called Spirit, and it's a piano-based album that I released in the middle of March. And I've gotten over 60,000 streams from the album on Spotify in that amount of time, which has been pretty great. It's been doing pretty well. And then I'm trying to license a couple of those tracks off to Sirius XM. And if that happens, then it's like really like it's fantastic.
Awesome. And spell your last name for people listening to this, if you could, please.
Yeah. Calandra.
Pete Calandra. Excellent. And if what I like to do at the end of each podcast is play a track from the featured guest. So if you can think of one off the top of your head, a title, that's great. If not, when we're done, you can send me whatever you want, and I'll play one of your tracks at the end of this so people can hear your music. Do you have anything in particular that comes to mind?
Yes, I do, but let me email you so that you can put it in and it'll sound really good as opposed to over Zoom. How's that sound?
Oh, no, of course. Yeah, if you know the title, though, we can mention that.
Oh, yes, that's great. So I'll send you a song of mine called First Light from my 2017 album, First Light.
First Light. Excellent. So, Pete, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate you taking the time. And let's do this again.
Yes, thank you so much. And you have a great day. And again, thank you so much for having me on. I really enjoyed talking with you.